All right, and welcome to this week's edition of the Your Favorite Band Podcast, a podcast where we talk to your favorite bands about how your favorite bands became your favorite bands. As usual, I'm with my good friend Dave. Dave, how are you, buddy?
Oh, man, am I doing well.
I'm so happy that your ability to be doing well is not dependent on my ability to ask the question.
Not only that, I'm glad that my ability to be doing well is not dependent on how well I'm actually doing, because I just kind of have that pre-programmed for this podcast. But we both know, I already told you, today was not the best one.
Yeah.
But, you get through them, though, you know?
And I'll be honest, Dave, when I ask the question about how you're doing, at this point, I don't care. Later on, I care a lot. But at this point, we've got...
That's not what this is about. Because this is the Your Favorite Band podcast, not the How's Dave Doing podcast.
Yeah, that'll be our next podcast for sure. And I think people will listen to that more so. Maybe not more so than this one, because it's a big...
Oh, yeah.
You see what I did?
Like, yeah, that's well done.
I didn't want to underplay our guest, because it's an exciting week. But at the same time, Dave's life is also great. Hey, Chad from King's Kaleidoscope is with us, and we are both really excited about it. Chad, good evening, or good day. I don't know when people are listening.
Hey, fellas. It's evening here, so that's right.
Great. Where are you at this point in time in your life?
Seattle, Washington, which is home.
Great.
So,
great.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
I'm hanging.
I've never been to Seattle. I hear it's a wonderful place if you like the rain.
Yeah, I mean, global warming's pretty awesome for Seattle. It only rains late fall, and the winter's long, that's true. We got a long rainy winter, but spring and summer are, I think, unbeatable.
Here.
Yeah, totally.
I want to go there so bad. I want to go there in Portland, do the old duo trip.
That's
the dream trip. It'll happen someday. Brand, you want to come with me?
Only if it's a part of the new podcast that we're starting.
Okay.
We'll see if we can double dip in that situation. Here's the thing. For those of you that have never listened to our podcast, what we desire to do with the Your Favorite Band podcast is talk about the life of a band from start until where they are now. And we usually do that by talking through a discography. But we're going to start from a little bit before that with this one. So Chad, we know you got into your band kind of formed and got started at Mars Hill, but talk about you, how you got involved with music and, kind of where you started. Were you in bands before Kings? Were you in bands before doing the whole church thing? So just talk about life before Kings for a little bit.
Sure. I grew up in a really musical family, and my parents were very musical and always were playing for church. And my dad did a lot of fingerstyle acoustic playing, and my mom was a singer. And just all through my extended family, music was a big thing. So I grew up very comfortable just with, the main instruments. Like, I had to take piano for 5 years as a young kid and hated it. I really wanted to play drums. And then after the 5 years, in fifth grade here, you pick your instrument. And I tried out for drums, played drums all growing up. My big musical sort of revelation and education came in middle school when I started DJing. And so I just was really into, at the time, it was like any hip hop coming out of Chicago. So Kanye and Common and Lupe Fiasco and just like the hip hop, I mean, the roots, like anything in the neo soul kind of wake. And was making tons of beats in middle school all the way through high school, just for fun, or then trying to give them to friends that rapped and stuff like that.
I need to know this. What program did you use to make your beats?
Oh, well, I mean, in sixth grade it was Acid, if anybody remembers. Acid.
And I also need to know that, because I feel like everybody our age kind of did you illegally download the program that you made beats on?
I just did demos forever of Acid. Like, I would just make new emails and then do trials, you know?
Everyone I knew downloaded Fruity Loops. Legally.
Yeah, Fruity Loops.
It was like one of the things you had to do.
I never like fully got into Fruity Loops, but a bunch of my friends did. I was like acid pro. And So that's basically how I learned to write and compose music was through sampling. I was super into, you know, sampling records and collecting them from old people in my church that were trying to get rid of their collections. So I just have like the worst vinyl collection, which is like a lot of records. Just like not good stuff.
That is such an interesting start, considering that you had the family that was kind of all spread out throughout church music and stuff like that, to have that divergence into like such a different thing is pretty cool. But it also, I think it does lay a good foundation for how you guys approach music now.
Totally. Go ahead.
You probably would answer the question, but I was going to say, how did that kind of continue on into getting to Marcel?
So, I mean, basically, you know, making beats, I ended up then singing a lot on them, and that was pretty natural for me. I'd been in a kids' choir growing up, and I was comfortable with that. I also, at the same time, was developing just playing music at church, leading worship, and different things like that all through high school. So, basically, at the end of high school, I took an internship at the church I grew up at, like a lot of guys do, just trying out being a worship leader for youth. And we started another service, that whole, you know, it's a common thing. But this, you know, all in high school, I was attending Mars Hill just maybe a couple times a month. I would drive into the city because I lived about half an hour outside of it and just catch the vibe and the vision and kind of meet the guys who were doing music there, and I would basically take their catalog and reinterpret it and play it at my other church. That also happens a lot. So I was really familiar. Basically, after the internship of 2 years right out of high school, I was 20 years old, and I kind of made the switch, went over to Mars Hill, and was part of a church plant on the University of Washington campus, and that's how King's Kaleidoscope started. That was the band I started that just led worship every week for basically 2 years. So, yeah.
Okay. I want to talk about the first EP you put out called Sin, which I love, by the way. I don't think enough people know about that EP. And the version of How Deep the Father's Love is my favorite of that song, and it makes me weep almost every time I listen to it. I love it. So thank you for doing that. But you recorded it on Good Friday, and it's obviously because of that it's a little bit of a darker project. So it makes it kind of an interesting thing for it to be your first release into the public world. So talk about why you decided for that darker, more thematic release to be your first release as a band.
It wasn't like a thoughtful thing like that as much, actually. Yeah. I mean, that's funny because that record, so I was, you know, 21 or 22 at this huge mega church. I had just got there. I'd been there for 8 months or something. And then they had me, basically lead that service. And, it just was like the musicians I rallied together and everything, what we were able to create just turned out to be, you know, just this beautiful, you know, gut-wrenching kind of thing. And it was so cool that it was after the fact that we decided, let's release this. This is really, you know, amazing. Okay. Also just with it being a mega church and like everything I did because I was working there was just the church owns it. So it was sort of the feeling of just like, as much music as we can just put out, let's just do it. There's a lot of like red tape in different places that, you know, like it's just a big organization. So anytime you can put out music, you just do it. So there was no like, how are we going to present ourselves to the world? We were really just putting it out for our own church, but there was a lot of other people paying attention, which was, you know, it was cool. So
yeah, for sure.
And you said that your goal with Sin was to fix Christian worship music as you were writing it. lyrically and musically, what were you trying to do that was different?
I think I would just say that, like, I had a big chip on my shoulder all growing up about that. And I think that was a big influence of, like, me being 15 years old and going to Mars Hill back in the day when, you know, they had that chip on their shoulder too. And I was really influenced by that. And I think there's some pride in that for sure. But also just, I don't know. It's a natural thing for me to try to color outside the lines in across the board. And in that role as a worship director, I was just kind of like bringing that personality trait into that. And I think that sometimes it was cool and sometimes it wasn't that helpful. I think for that record specifically, though, you know, it definitely gave me this feeling of, as a kid, I'd always thought, I'm going to stick it to CCM and make something that's so true and so beautiful and so theologically correct and at the same time so musically brilliant that nobody can deny it. Like, so just ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And I feel like for being like really young, like I kind of did it on the first try in a sense. It sounds super proud, I know, but like, that record's really cool. I'm really proud of it, honestly. Yeah. And what I was left with was like, oh, that's now I've reached the top of this little mountain that I made myself, you know, I made my own goal and I got to the top of it. And that was kind of pathetic. What's next? And so in the end, ultimately, that whole like goal was not as satisfying as I was hoping it would be. And that's what you learn in full-time ministry is as I kept, you know, working along at that church, and it just realized like, oh, this is about people and this is about the gospel and discipleship. And the, you know, the joy of being in full-time ministry is seeing people's lives transformed by the gospel, or seeing them really get God in new ways or experience him in new ways. And so that was a lesson for me, basically, like getting what I wanted and not having it satisfy me was ultimately like God's grace. And it was a great lesson for me.
Yeah. I mean, I'll say this, like you said, what, you were 21, 22.
Yeah.
Like that, like one of my favorite songs on the EP is What Have We Done? Like, I feel like it like just champions the fact that we are the chief of sinners. Like the fact right. that you would have sold Jesus out for less than mm-hmm. Judas and stuff like that. Like, I think that's a super lofty thing for a 21-year-old, 22-year-old to be thinking through. So I'm interested mm-hmm. in kind of, at the time, that was what, 2011? So
yeah.
What was kind of, how important was Mars Hill up to that point in kind of the shaping of the way that you were thinking about God and Christianity and stuff like that? How important was Pastor Mark's preaching at the time in your life?
I mean, it was the most important. It's like foundational. You know, I got brought to Mars Hill when I was 15 years old, and that shaped tons of my worldview and my theology. I mean, it still has up to this point, but... Right. Especially as a young man, like that was pretty paramount. Even though, you know, from 18 to 20, I was right out of high school, I was working for a different church. I was still visiting there. And I mean, it was just like the elephant in the room. I couldn't visit any other church in the state of Washington and not be hearing about Mars Hill or, you know, just come up all the time.
The reputation of Mars Hill around the, like, I know what it was across the country in Florida and South Carolina. What was it in the Seattle area? Was it well liked by other people, or what was it like there?
It was just divisive. You know, I mean, as divisive as Donald Trump. It's like people just loved it or they just hated it.
Sure.
And the truth is, like, there's just a plethora on all sides of things that were impactful to me about it. There was a lot of good things. I met, you know, probably some of the best men and women I've ever met in my life, and I still continue to be friends with to this day. I mean, by far, I've met I've met some of the most godly men ever that were part of that church, and same the other way around. Like, just like I met people that I'm like, gosh, I know God loves you, but you're a slime ball. Like, just, you know what I mean? Like, it's sad. It's really sad. So I don't know. That's probably what the reputation was. I mean, the people that I grew up with when I wasn't at Mars Hill definitely were same thing across the board. Like, just outside of Seattle, it was like people either really got it, they liked it, or they didn't. So I think that's because it was a mixed bag, truly.
Sure. Oh, my soul.
Going into the next record, the Aesop's Arrows, you did a lot of reimagined hymns, which was a thing at Mars Hill. Why was that such an important part of the culture at Mars Hill? To do the hymns.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of if I can actually know why it was, because I sort of like a lot of this stuff. You got to realize, like, I was pretty young, so I was just adopting. I was like inheriting. All these other guys' forethought and conviction, in a sense. Like, I was sort of buying into what they had bought into. I think that, obviously, there's a lot of hymns that are really, really well written. And there's something really powerful and beautiful about singing songs that the church has sung for hundreds of years. And I think that was a major pull. I think, once again, like, there was also a slight maybe chip on the shoulder pull of, like, we're not going to sing Chris Tomlin. We're just going to redo hymns. And it was like trendier. But Aesop's Arrows was like, once again, was just a little bit of me sort of like banging my hands on the walls. It felt that way to me, at least, of just like, let us put out music. King's Kaleidoscope is making really cool music. I want us to put out music. Like, we had put out the Sin thing, and it was like, what can we do next? What can we do next? We got snuffed to make our first full length, in favor of Citizens, who got to do the first full length, which was like, I was so mad about that, honestly. I don't think I've talked about this in an interview yet, but that's kind of funny. Like, we were around at first, and
what's funny is we interviewed Zach before we interviewed you. So again, they just keep beating you guys.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like, so Zach got to Mars Hill because I got transferred from that University of Washington church to the main campus to be the worship director. Okay. And then we had to sort of like find a replacement, and we found Zach. So then when he got to do the first record, I was super, super pissed. Not at him, like, at all. Just the system that was in place. But anyway, so Aesop's Arrows was like sort of in a little, it was like, yeah, we're trying to put out EPs. You should do one. All the bands did one. And we just picked the songs that we were really comfortable with that we'd been playing for church for a long time. So I think those arrangements are really cool. And obviously, like, Come Thou Fount is, according to Spotify, is on like a billion churches pre-post playlist every Sunday morning.
It's on mine.
Before and after services. Yeah, because it gets played so many times, which is awesome. I think that's the coolest song on that record for sure.
Well, I'm like, I'm not going to try to do that version because I would just totally mess it up. So I'll just play it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one thing I found interesting as I was like looking up dates and stuff like that today is your first LP came out in 2014. Like, I think it was like 2 or 3 days before Mars Hill announced that it was dissolving, which is just a fascinating thing to me.
Wow.
Yeah, I think it was your album came out, what was it, October like 27th or something? And then Mars Hill announced on October 30th, I think. So,
which is interesting. I didn't even realize that. That's wild. So,
I'm imagining that the writing and the recording kind of – a lot of that came out of what happened at Mars. So talk about kind of how Mars Hill influenced the writing of that album and everything that was going on around you there.
Yeah. Well, basically, you know, like Mars Hill had been rough for a long time. I'd been there kind of hunkered down at that point for probably, well, that at least up to that year for about 2 years where it was like the staff turnover was ridiculous. Every pastor that I'd worked with that I really respected and, you know, wanted to be under their discipleship had left. It was sort of like earlier when I was saying I've met some of the best men and women ever, they had all sort of left for the most part at that point, just because they couldn't change the overall culture and the bad parts of the structure of the church. And so my wife and I were just kind of hunkered down, trying to get through it, trying to be sort of a barrier between the way things were going and all the volunteers and the people that, you know, we cared about at the church. And we ended up, we both ended up resigning on the same day. She worked there as well. We met planting the church on the University of Washington. So that's all we'd really known. And we both just were kind of, eventually, you know, things hit the wall into a way that we were just like, all right, we can't actually change anything here, and this is just not good for us. It's not good for our relationship. We're not going to be able to change this. We need to bail.
And when was that?
That was December of that – of what would that be? 2013, actually. Yeah, okay. 2013. So basically, then we just had a onslaught of hardships. My wife got in a car accident the week after we resigned, and just wasn't a terrible car accident, but our car was totaled and her like foot got really messed up. Mm-hmm. And then basically just shortly after that, her father was diagnosed with cancer out of nowhere, brain cancer, and passed away 10 weeks later, like out of nowhere, stage 4.
Wow.
That was ridiculous. I mean, just awful stuff. Yeah. And then we got pregnant, and that was sort of the, this light at the end of the tunnel, and we lost our firstborn son to a stillbirth that summer. And this is all while we basically go from double income to zero income, and I'm trying to then make craft this first record. It was sort of like we had saved enough money to live for a couple months, and it was like, Chad's just going to go make a record, clear our heads, let's just do this. So I'm producing and recording this record for the first time. I've never done this before in my life. Like, I'd never done that. And I was doing it all. And then, even after we lost our son Zion, then a couple weeks later, one of my wife's, her great aunt and one of her grandmas died the same night. It was just like the craziest stuff, just one after another. Plus dealing with all of the Mars Hill crap that was like going on consistently, because we still had friends that were there and staff member, and then we had other friends that had moved on, and that's enough drama for a couple of years in it by itself. And so the process of making Becoming Who We Are is not just us leaving Mars Hill as like my church family and the biggest, you know, like I said earlier, influence on my life up to that point. It's also all these other things. It's me learning how to, you know, get through hardships with my wife for the first time, kind of on our own. And there's little songs on that record that you wouldn't think that come out of that. Like Ache is a song about when our marriage was really on the rocks while we were right before we had kind of left Mars Hill, and Mars Hill, just being in that environment was something that was extremely difficult on our marriage specifically. And, you know, or there is a song Zion, which is for my son on the record.
Right.
And then I just think that it's one of those magical things where, because there was so much stuff going on, the emotion with which, like, that all those are songs were recorded with is sort of like this magic that you couldn't, you know, I couldn't do it again the same way at all. And so when we finally released that record, then that next fall, yeah, that's wild. Marceau closed, I guess, like right after that. But it was this extreme, like, birth process. Like, it was like we just, we had not birth. That's the wrong word. I don't know. It was like we had flushed out the whole system. It was like everything that was in me, all of the fears and the frustrations, and then all of the longing and angst that I had for God in the middle of all of it. Even if it was, you know, poured into a hymn that we had done before in the past that I just wanted to be able to have our own recording of out in the world, like, you know, whatever, you know, Dustin's Grace Alone or something like that. Like,
yeah.
It all went into that record, and then it just all got released, and it was this huge pressure valve release of, like, Kings has been doing this for a long time, and this is actually who we are. We get to say it. It's on our own terms. We're not part of this thing that's falling apart anymore. And also, just this is what God's been doing in me through all this stuff that's been going on, and this is what I believe. It just was like a – I mean, I love the way that that record was able to come together, and I'm really thankful for it.
Yeah.
But it was definitely intense.
Yeah, it's so, yeah, so good though. It was a great, great album.
Absolutely.
I want just a little bit of a kind of a follow up. Like, yeah, what was it about the culture that was so hard? Like, I hear it from Zach when we talk to him, and obviously just all the websites and the things. If you just want to dive into the darkness of the internet, you just read what the internet is about Driscoll.
Right.
Like, what was it about it that was so just hard?
It's really, really hard to distill because I don't think I'm that smart. I think obviously the things that are obvious is, like, there was the whole church was oriented towards growth, which made it hungry for power and influence, and that made us, you know, abuse volunteers and staff and each other, and so something's oriented that way. But then there's major structural problems, like there's just no checks and balances. So to some extent, there wasn't enough, right? And so, if you know, there was just calls made all the time from the top down that were like, "We should not do this," but you can't really not do it. You just have to do it. And so that just caused things to be just oriented really, really poorly all the way around.
So,
just a bad structure and a bad focus and a bad motive really ate at the culture. I think one thing that maybe not a lot of people talk about is there was a huge shame culture. So people have, you know, in bigger churches, people will say, like, "Oh, it's a culture of fear," but it's like, that's not really a thing. Like, what are you afraid of? And the thing was that it was like, okay. So, like, if an executive elder walks into church and the people at the front doors aren't like smiling enough, you know, it was like the executive pastor for that location would get an email that's like, "You need to change this. They're not smiling enough. They're not warm enough. They're not friendly enough." And it was like, he was being shamed. The church was being shamed for not like stepping up their game. And it's just like, I mean, there's so many things wrong with that on a lot of levels.
Right.
And that's just like, that was regular practice. So
sure. From your perspective, do you feel like the blame was too firmly on Mark, because it sounded like you said, like if it was just like an elder or something like that, like all the blame seems to go on Mark and the way that Mark handled himself and handled the church. But can it be, should the blame be extended elsewhere, or is that just?
Oh yeah, I think the blame should be extended to the people who went to the church that bought into, you know, a lot of things that were just ridiculous.
Yeah.
But I think that the response, there's a major responsibility that has fallen on Mark that he hasn't actually taken responsibility for. And I think that's what's leaving a lot of bad taste in people's mouths.
Sure.
They just don't know how to vocalize it. Yeah. So,
right.
I discussed this a little bit with Zach. Like, I think Mars is such an interesting case study for churches when deciding the reason, the mission and purpose of a church.
Yeah.
Like, I think, like, talking to Zach, Zach's like, we did the mega church thing and now we just don't want to anymore. And I think if somebody were to study Mars Hill, you'd see all of the flaws from that can come with a mega church. Like when you're going, when you're putting a man on the top in a church setting, it's flawed. It's not, it will not be sustainable. So what's your thought process on church now? Like, are you like, we're never doing the mega church thing again, or what's your thought process there?
Yeah. I mean, I think emotionally we're definitely like, my family still is, we walk into big churches and we just smile at each, like my wife and I just smile at each other. Like we see the executive pastor like hustling around with like a worried look on his face and he's worried about, you know, whatever. And it's, we just laugh. Like we're just like, not that important. That dude's running himself into the ground. And it doesn't matter. You know, but I don't like throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I don't think like I'm not like here to say like, no, medium-sized churches are the only way, or like house churches are where it, like,
sure.
There's a healthy pendulum swings. And I think right now, most people I know want to be in smaller churches, and it's funny. We go to the same church as Zach Bolin. Oh, okay. We're actually in the same community group and we live like down the street from each other. So I saw them yesterday. We see them all the time. Our families
that's
just, are
that's close. That's an unfair, unfairly musically gifted
church. Yeah, I know. Well, it's funny because we don't even participate. Like, Zach's played guitar once with our worship director, or twice, and I've done the same. But our worship director is incredibly talented, and they make, I mean, he does an incredible job. But still, like, we just attend. But yeah, we go to a Presbyterian church that's couple hundred people, and we love it. It's just very normal. I don't think that I don't know. I just think in a my vibe, the vibe that I have is just that the idea of church being cool anymore, especially in a progressive like coastal city, especially on the West Coast, is just not going to be appealing really for a lot of people. The non-Christian friends that I have, just if I was like, they expect church to be church. Like, it's still church. You know, it's not actually going to be like, you're not going to win them over with a rock band or slides or something like, or like, you know, because you got a graphics, like, you know, a 20-year-old that can do graphics. Like, it's not, they don't care. It's church. They want to know this substance is what they want if they're coming with you. Right. But like I said, that's just my sort of perspective on it right now, and things will just change again. Like, it'll be totally different in 10 years from now, I'm sure, and it'll be different again 10 years after that. But the thing that I do like a lot about my church right now, that I think is why that pendulum is swinging that way, is the liturgy and the silence, and the it's the only hour and a half I have all week that I can actually turn off my phone and I don't have to worry about it. Cause it's Sunday morning. It's not like an evening thing where I'm trying to figure out plans afterwards. It's like, it's Sunday morning, regular church time. It's the only time where I sit and I hear scripture read to me. And then there's just silence afterwards with some music, and there's no distraction. There's not even a screen in my church. And in a overly like internet inundated world, where just I'm on Twitter and Instagram all the time, or even for work, like I have to be, cause I, you know, I'm a musician and I have a band, that's the only place in my world right now that that exists. And I think that's extremely appealing and will become more appealing to more people to just have that be really an actual Sabbath from even technology and stress and work and all of that. So
yeah,
I'm glad I don't have to like tweet in questions to the pastor for some guy backstage to pick out of, like, you know what I mean? Like, that's what's going on. And then he puts it on the screen and then answers it to 1,000 people. Like, I'm glad I don't have to do that at church right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. To kind of bring it back to Kings, at what point did that become a separate entity than Mars Hill? And how did that kind of affect going into the newer record that just came out? And
yeah,
was that a smooth transition?
I mean, it was part of the roughness of leaving Mars Hill. Unfortunately, when we left, you know, when my wife and I left, I had to prove to the church that I owned the name King's Kaleidoscope, because I had started the Facebook with the name before I was a staff member.
Oh.
So I had started when I was an intern. If I had started it a couple months later when I was a staff member, they would have owned the name and they wouldn't have given me even the rights to the name.
That's crazy.
It was brutal. Also,
do you own the first two EPs?
No. So that's even more. I mean, the
Who
whole
owns
thing.
It?
Okay, so, oh, guys, you have no idea. I had already recorded 60 to 70% of Becoming Who We Are. Well, it was the earlier version of it at the church. And for a lot of reasons, they weren't going to let me finish it, which was sort of like the last Jenga piece that was like, all right, I'm out of here. I can't even do what I'm literally made to do at this church. So I'm out of here. So, and then I went, when I left, they couldn't do anything with it because I owned the publishing on it.
Right.
And it was literally going to sit. It was just instrumentals, but it was literally going to sit on a shelf and just rot at the church. And I offered to buy it from them. I was like, add up whatever you want to, you know, call it. It's 60% done. I have no money, but I will get, like, I can give you $10,000 or whatever, like 13,000. I think it was like $13,000 is what they were like. Well, it might be worth this much for this, the track so far, you know, 60% of it. I was like, I'll kickstart it. I'll do it. They would not sell it to me at all. Period.
Oh my
gosh. On principle, because I left the church.
Oh,
so I re-recorded the entire thing.
Are you serious?
Yep. So like there is. Yeah, totally.
Wow.
And yeah, it was terrible. And then the label that I signed with, Tooth and Nail, they bought out all of the Mars Hill Music records, and because Mars Hill wouldn't supposedly broker individual deals with all the artists. And so, and Tooth and Nail, even though, like, I don't know, I was really frustrated with them as well. This is like the freaking dirt, like, I've never like spun this much dirt on an interview before, but it was frustrating because they bought all of our old EPs and they wouldn't sell them to me. So Tooth and Nail owns all those EPs and I basically don't make any money on them at all. so there you go.
Dude,
all of
it that's the rough. Literally the worst case scenario.
Yep, exactly. So
but one thing I want to know is how this is, you can't answer. I'm sure you can't answer this question, but it appears as though Mark's messages are all on his website. So I want to know how much he paid for his messages.
I have no idea. I don't even know if he had to pay for them, honestly.
That's just,
let's just put it this way. Depending on where you were at the right time, you walked away with like different assets and resources Marcel had and didn't have to account for them.
That's amazing.
Wow.
Unless you were Chad Gardner and then you didn't get your multitracks or your old EPs. Yeah.
That's not what I like to hear.
No. So obviously when we released our first record, once again, it felt like, oh my gosh, finally everything is behind us. We're a band now and we're just going to put all this stuff out. But then that by the time that record came out, I legitimately had a nervous breakdown and spent, you know, a year and a half, 2 years having crazy panic attacks. I've struggled with anxiety disorder my whole life, but
sure.
It just like took it to the next level. I was seeing doctors and getting the whole nine yards, like heart scans and like different supplements and all this
stuff. Well, I would struggle with anxiety too if I had to fork over $13,000 the stems of 60% of my songs.
And then they were like, no, so I redid it. I mean, it is what it is. Like, the thing, here's the thing is, I don't excuse that by saying this, because I still think it was not, there was no brotherly love within that, and it was just wrong on a lot of levels. But God redeemed it, and I cut my chops making that first record. Yeah. I mean, I learned how to do everything. I grinded the whole thing out with the help of like really close friends that I would just call every day. I mean, I'd call producer friends, just be like, hey, where do I put this mic? You know, like, or like just anything like that, borrowing gear from people. I cut my teeth on that. And that's such a gift that I was able to learn so quickly. And also through the process, I was able to write a whole new set of songs, which got added to that record. And that record is totally different, you know, yeah. Now. And I think it's a lot better. It's still a pain, but God redeemed it. And I'm grateful for that, for sure.
That brings us to Beyond Control, came out earlier this year. Talk about kind of the goal with that one. Obviously, this kind of seems like your first real one. Like, that's just kind of separate from all of that.
Yeah.
So what was your goal with this LP and your thought process and the writing process of it?
Yeah. Well, basically... So I think the songs, let's talk about lyrics and themes.
Sure.
They very clearly are coming, they're me coming to grips with the last years of my life, sort of, and all the healing that I've been doing. So refinding God, learning to see the world around me in a certain way through all this really intense anxiety and this, you know, whole freak out post Mars Hill, post flushing out the system with becoming who we are. This is sort of my, like, all right, I think I got a handle on things now project, in that sense. And the whole like overarching theme of the record, which kind of goes between this enchanted world where I'm enamored in God's presence, or I'm lost in complete and utter darkness, or just distraction and modern life. That was from a sermon that I heard at church that really was really powerful for me mm-hmm. along the way throughout that process. So that's on the theme side. The nuts and bolts side, I respond really well to challenges. And it was basically coming up to, this is like last February or something. We had basically heard from the label, hey, with all the other releases we have, you know, you're probably going to have to release your next record if you're working on it right now, all the way next year. Like basically not even now. Like I'd be thinking about releasing this record. Or no, it would be. It'd be about now. Like I would have been releasing Beyond Control like this month at some point.
Is this Tooth and Nail?
Tooth and Nail, yeah.
Okay.
So, and I was like, oh man, that's going to suck. I've been coming up slowly with all these ideas for songs. I've got like musical ideas all over the place. And I've been stirring on all these themes for the first time where I'm primary songwriter. And not even that. I feel like for the first time in my life, I really have a lot of things I want to say. And in the type of music that this is, where it's not really just pop music. I mean, this is like, you know, this is you know, kind of deeper themes and spiritual themes or hymns or whatever. Like this is feeling very, very fresh to me. This a whole new thing of like, I have something really to say in a lot of these songs, and it's not just me finding a cooler way to do, you know, Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing or a one-off song about something really intense. It's like, I have a vision for a whole project. So I told Tooth and Nail, okay, I don't want to wait till next fall. I know you got all these releases. What if I deliver you the masters in, you know, 3 months or less than 3 months? And they're like, well, have you started yet? And I was like, no, but I think I can do it. So we did I wrote all of the lyrics, all the songs, recorded the whole thing in like, you know, 10 weeks. I think, yeah, it was 10 weeks.
My goodness.
We had a small band.
I don't know if you know that or not.
And we were going to the UK for the first time to play a few shows. And the day we had to fly, I went to the mastering studio. We mastered the record. I got on the plane with the masters and we flew, and then I sent it to the record company, and the record came out, I think, 4 or 5 weeks after that.
Oh my gosh. So, I didn't realize it was so quick.
Oh my goodness. But you know what? It wasn't a bad quick though. Like usually that means like it's a bad product or something. But I really just had such a clear vision and concept for what I wanted the record to be. And I really went into it just without any fear of musically or like, this is a sophomore record. No matter what, people aren't going to like it because it's different than your first one. And it's going to be different because I'm not going to make the same record again.
Yep.
And so I just stuck to the theme, and I stuck to what I really felt burdened to be writing about. And musically, I think it's a little more cohesive and still, you know, pretty adventurous. And it's the same thing I've always done musically, but I just made what I really liked. I made what I wanted to listen to over and over again. And like that was it. Three months later, it was like out on the internet, and we were like, oh, we did it. That's awesome. It was kind of crazy.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So there's a lot of buzz around A Prayer,
right?
And because you guys are of just the nature of the industry that you're in, and
sure,
perceived as a worship band, and your songs are sung in churches across the country.
Right.
What went into the decision to include the F word and talk about the decision to do that, and how, like, what was the process for that one?
I mean, that decision took a long time, honestly, because I sort of just sang that line in sort of off the top of my head, and the song came together pretty quickly. Actually, this is really funny. I've said this maybe before, but I don't know, for new people. But so that song was called Misstep, and it was going to be the pop song for the album. And so it didn't have lyrics yet. I had like a DJ Chad demo. It was literally four on the floor. That guitar line, like that, was like this dance thing. And that was one of the first songs when I said, you know, I can do this record in 3 months. That was the one that was like, yeah, we'll be all right. I got this pop jam that's really catchy, and you sing da 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 over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And every time I tried to approach that, I could not like touch it. I could not get my head around that song. Anybody that would come over to my house, like my mom would be babysitting. We've got a little boy now. And I'd be like, Mom, come listen to this. How should I structure this? I just couldn't get anywhere. Nobody in the band could help me get it anywhere. And then when I approached it the opposite way, you know, this one time was just like, oh wow, this is a vehicle for all of this, this panic and terror that I've experienced in spurts over the last 2 years, you know, having this breakdown. This just works. The vehicle is perfect. Like it was the 808 and the piano and the spooky sounds, like everything just, it like literally was like the song was given to me. I couldn't believe, I've never had anything happen to me that fast where it was just like, this is meant to be. I didn't even plan this out. This is just what this song is supposed to do. It's just supposed to carry this stuff. So then I had this thing that felt like this song has just happened and it's perfect for what it is. What am I going to do with it? I obviously was talking to the label about it a bunch, talking to all of my friends about it, talked to my pastor about it, and it was really just a back or forth thing. There was no yeah or no that was clear for a long time. It was like, you can go either way on it, and praying about it was like, so for me, you know, the F-bomb in that context, it's like, I don't believe it's sinful. So am I playing by my convictions to edit it, or am I playing by the market, you know, because, or like, how do I still respect people? It was this, I mean, there's so many questions. I had friends who were theologians and authors that I was putting it by and stuff. And at the end of the day, I just felt the most peace about just having both.
Yeah.
I really wanted to, I don't know. It's like the song is a testimony. It's a straight up testimony for me. And to alter it just to be able to sell our records in Christian bookstores, which, by the way, they don't sell our records anymore because of that song. Like, Lifeway won't take any of our CDs at all, even though all the CDs are edited. I felt like that was the only reason why I would edit it, was to be able to keep some sort of contact with that world. And
well, it's not like you get paid for any of your albums anyway, so.
Well, yeah, it just, it felt like it just, what it, I didn't have integrity changing it for those reasons, obviously. And, but then at the same time, I'm like, well, I know there's tons of people, even people I know that like don't want to listen to it or wouldn't even agree with it. But the song is, I think, maybe one of the most powerful songs Kings has gotten to do. And so let's release it with an edited version. So I did the edited version as well. And I just decided we're going to put out both. The label got behind it. It was always up to me. It was never up, like, they were, you can do whatever you want. But it was the question of, is it going to come out on Tooth and Nail, or is it going to come out on Gospel Song Union or Gospel Song Records? Sorry. But Gospel Song Records still decided, like, oh, we're going to put it out. This is, you know, we're going to get behind it. And, you know, it was thought out, you know, when you read comments online and people are like, you know your audience and all, it's like, yeah, I totally know my audience. And I know that 15-year-old kids everywhere in high schools that are like suicidal, and they're not offended by a word. It's real for them. Like, they are actually terrified of death. They don't know if God loves them beyond it. And this is what God said to me in those moments. So why not just say that to the people that are feeling the same things?
Yeah.
Like, as is, it's not an issue. You like, and this isn't like, this is the future of Christian music. Like, this isn't the future. This is like right now. It's frustrating to me in a lot of ways, but it's also, I understand, and I do honestly respect people. I don't like snicker behind people's backs about it and stuff like that. I really felt like the right thing to do is put out both. And honestly, the people that have been really upset about it, is obvious. It's such a minority, and they're really vocal, and I get it, because they're passionate and they have their convictions. But it's not anywhere near compared to the people that are really, really like genuinely moved by it. And so, I have no regrets at all. Like, you know, we're now a couple months out. It's been out there. The storm has passed. We're on tour now. So I get to hear lots of stories about it, and I'm definitely glad we did it.
Do you sing it live or do you censor it?
It just depends on how the Holy Spirit moves me.
There you go.
That's a fun thing to get to do. Well, I should say I prefer the version with it. That's me. I went and talked with Brian about this, but that's I like.
Well, I also myself. It was weird because I heard the unedited one or the uncensored one first. And yeah. When you hear the censored one, it's like that sounds weird.
I know. I know.
But it's funny how that word like it. Sorry, Brian. No, you can go.
No, you go.
Okay, it's just funny how certain genres or in certain situations it sticks out. I mean, it's that word obviously floats around in a lot of different genres of music as a commonplace. But then you get like something like Mumford and Sons. They like were one of the first songs that I heard that sounded like that kind of music, where they just put it in so naturally.
Yeah.
And then you go, okay, this just feels like it. If you put anything else there, it would be ridiculous.
It would just
be so ridiculous.
And it's just like if you change it, it's because here's the thing: it's not even a good lyric. Like if you're talking about nuts and bolts songwriting, I don't even think the song "Nuts and Bolts" is that great. It doesn't matter though because when somebody gets in a car crash or they're just terrified for their life, they're not thinking poetically or like they're not writing what they're saying. So when I'm just like spilling my guts on a song, that's what it is. And you can feel it. So changing it to be sort of this like, and I'm not saying you shouldn't write well-crafted songs. I think there's space for all kinds of expression. And that moment of that expression, just the whole song really as a whole is, it's just guts and it works really. I think it works great. So.
And if you think about it, it's really just locker room talk.
Oh my gosh.
You're welcome. How many people did you respond to on Facebook before you decided that this is a pointless conversation?
I actually decided not to respond to anybody. I didn't respond I didn't post anything for maybe like a week or two at least. And I posted one thing that was like kind of sarcastic on Twitter about like, and it was after people were just getting like brutal. Like it was a kid would post, you know, I'm glad that they released this version of it. And some other kid would post, cussing is a sin, you idiot. and I would just be like, oh my gosh, dude, you just called that guy an idiot. You know how like demeaning that is, you know, or somebody on,
oh, man.
I mean, it's still there. All this stuff like on iTunes is like, you know, Chad, you should just release a sex tape because that would be being like vulnerable and honest. And you're just like, oh my gosh, like the level was so ridiculous that I, you know, said a few things, but, I mean, people around me just kept me like, you're not actually convincing anybody of anything. And in general, I'm not like, I hate Facebook. I don't even have Facebook actually, but I don't do like comment sections and arguments, stuff like that. So I really just stayed off of it almost entirely. And I have to this point. I talk about it in interviews. That's about all.
Yeah.
The most ironic thing about somebody saying that it's like, if you put a sex tape, is that that means that them saying it is as bad as you doing it. Just like you saying that word is as bad as
I know. It's just
so it's
I mean, the iTunes ones were the worst because it was like for a week, you know, we were in the top five. I mean, we were number two for a long time. And it's like you just completely random people that have no idea who we are because we're still a super niche band are just looking at the second record is a explicit record and they're just commenting immediately.
Right.
So it's not even that it has been frustrating, but overall it's sort of like, I mean, I expected it. It's not surprising to me.
Right. That went into the decision.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah.
Last question about it and then we'll move on.
Yeah.
As a worship leader myself and, someone who, is in circles with many a worship leaders. I've had worship leaders say, I'm nervous to tell people to go look up King's Kaleidoscope because that's the version that they might find of that song. And like, does that put me in a weird position as a worship leader and stuff like that? So how would you, as the writer of that song and also somebody who has led worship, help worship leaders think about that and pointing people in the direction of your music?
I like, I mean, my first gut is like, does everybody in your church live under a rock or something? Yeah. Like, is there not, like, does sin not affect your church? Is there not people that are going through divorces and cancer and death and all that stuff that feel that way and mm-hmm. that need to hear the gospel in those times? Like, or that they have never heard that word in the movie that they watched last weekend or mm-hmm. on the street or at preschool, honestly. Like, it's like, for me, it's sort of like I'm actually so beyond the conversation of like, Christians continually redefining their subculture and picking and choosing rules to try to like feel self-righteous about. I just didn't want to deal with it. Yeah. So it also is like, if I just say fuck on a record, I don't have to deal with it anymore. I'm not going to accidentally be in playing a show at one of those churches and then my guitar player says, you know, shit or something like that. And then it's a problem. Like, I don't have to deal with that anymore if I just put it out there. And so I guess it's just,
so what I hear you saying is you really just said it because your guitars have filthy mouths.
Yeah, exactly. No, but it's just like, you're missing the point of the entire song.
Yeah.
That song is a gospel song that is for everybody who has ever been afraid to die. Like, that is a gospel song. It's what the Holy Spirit said to me. So if you're worried about a word, you're missing the whole point. And I don't think you have a good read or pulse on your congregation, or there's, in my opinion, from my perspective, there's a lot of problems about the energy that your congregation is putting into certain morality things, because there's, I mean, and I get it. It's conviction. Like, I understand that there's different convictions on that. I mean, like, shit is not a bad word in my house. It's used like crap, and that's totally different for somebody else. Mm-hmm. So I understand that, but I don't know, man. I'm just the demographic that I'm around is just so different than, I mean, it's like a lot of other churches. So it's hard for me to necessarily understand it.
I mean, what's interesting is like, if people didn't think of you guys as a primarily a worship band, I don't think we'd be having this conversation. Like, that's the interesting, the fact that you guys started in the church and your first, two EPs were primarily just hymns and like all of that baggage that goes a lot like that, that'll stick with you. So I think that's part of the thing to wrestle with is like, what are you guys? Like, I think that's what people are wondering when they see that, like the people that are upset and decide that they need to post on your Facebook page because they're just like, I don't even know what these guys are anymore. So it's just like an interesting, like, why is it so important to put labels on bands? Like,
well, I understand it though. Like, I understand having to classify genres. I'm not just going to like go in a, you know, in my buddy's car and be like, oh, let's just play some music. You know, like, like when we're driving around, I want to like pick what something sounds like. I understand that.
I wish people would say that to me more often. Yeah. They always request like the most specific thing. I'm like, man, how about we just play what I want to play?
Right. Yeah. It's like, no, it's, yeah, rock is different than rap. Like, it just is. And it's, right. I can categorize that all day long. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I'm going to put a genre on it. So it really is a cultural thing. It's American Western Christian subculture has a thing. And I don't think people that are like 100% in it and that just sort of live in that environment understand that it's different than that would have been 50 years ago. And it's different than that would be if they lived in the UK, or it's different than if they lived in New Zealand, right? Like, different places around the world have different theologies, or not even different theologies, but I'm talking like secondary issues. Like, what is a swear word and what isn't a swear word? Yeah. Or if Paul's saying, you know, coarse language, like what is coarse language? What isn't coarse language? You know, like that is definitely a secondary issue.
Yes.
And by no means am I like trying to offend somebody intentionally or demean somebody or degrade anything like by using that word in a song. It's serving an emotional purpose really well. And yeah, it is interesting to see how different people that live in different cities or different countries, they see it completely differently.
Yeah. Well, please. Well, like, well, yeah. Sorry. Well, go, Dave.
I was going to say that as far as the genre of contemporary Christian music, the thing that makes it kind of unique versus all other kinds of music is that attached with it is this, it's somebody's comfort music, but at the same time, they're challenge music, but they like want to feel comfortable in how they're challenged. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like they need like to hear the Lord speak to them in a very specific tone, this very specific simplicity. And it's weird that people are like, and it's such a weird thing for that to have that place in your life. Like you're listening to music for that purpose.
Right. You're listening to it because it's your truth. It's what you believe. Mm-hmm. It helps bolster your faith. And
right.
That's just interesting because that's why I think I write songs like that too. I mean, I don't have to write songs about God anymore or faith or this any part of that journey. I could write pop songs if I wanted to, but I think it's just so instilled in me that music has been a place for me to do that because I was in full-time ministry for so long that just singing the gospel is such a intertwined thing with music in me. It's so natural. And I get that too, because for me, playing King's Kaleidoscope is singing myself truth. It's challenging my faith. It's reminding myself about the gospel. So, you know, if I was somebody else and I had totally different convictions and I'd grown up in a different family and went to a different church, and then I heard, you know, my favorite band, King's Kaleidoscope, drop the F-bomb, it would be really uncomfortable. I'd be pissed off. You know, I can understand it. It's intertwined. It's so interesting.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I personally, that's the song I'm most excited to hear live. Like the response part of that song is so good. I'm so excited. Speaking of which, you are currently on tour with Citizens and Saints.
Yes.
You're doing the West Coast, Midwest, East type thing. So how can people find out where you're going to be? And also, when can we expect more from you?
Oh, man. Well, liveloveTour.com is where we're, you know, all the dates are, and there's VIP packages and stuff. And yeah, we just did the first West Coast run and it was amazing. Like we've never done runs like this before, like actual tours. We've just always done flyouts. We just drop into places, weekends, couple in a row. And this is the first time we're like, you know what? We just want to really get around the country. We're like established now. And it's just been incredible. People have just been singing along super loud. So that's where all the info is. And I mean, yeah, we just love to meet people before and after the shows. And it's been wild.
How big is the band that you're touring with? Is it the full studio band, or is it a little bit more stripped down? Or
our current lineup is 7 people right now, which is still, fairly
still large,
big. Yeah, we've had up to 10 in the past when we have like full string sections or different things like that. But it's impossible to have that many people get work off the same time, or just the logistics that are crazy. So for even actually the past year, Kings is usually like 6 or 7 people, and on rare occasion we'll like have a full strings trio play with us, or like an extra horn player or extra drummer or something like that. So we're a rocking 7 piece, and it actually doesn't feel light to us anymore. At first it did, and then we'd be like, there's still 7 people on stage.
Is it going to be the same 7 on each leg of the tour, or do you have to swap them out because of work stuff?
No, it's the same. I think we might our violinist might switch out. But that's it. It's the core six. There's like a core, and it's the same guys that have been doing it for 3 years or so.
That's
so
awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really cool. I mean, my guess is no one literally cared about that question, but I'm just fascinated. So I just asked it.
Somebody did.
It's super specific, Brandon.
Thank you.
You're the logistics guy. So
listen, I love myself a good logistic.
You're the log man.
Thank you. I've never been complimented better in my life. I think that's it, man. Thank you so much for spending an hour with us talking about your music, and keep going at it, man. Keep going at it, please.
Thank you, guys. Hold on. One more thing. You asked what's next.
Oh yeah, I did, and you didn't.
I didn't answer. I have been doing. This is the first time I've said that. Well, there's been hints on social media, but I've been doing a bunch of production work for Andy Mineo. So I've been getting back to my roots and making some beats and doing, I'm loving the ideas we're coming up with, and that stuff will be out, whenever that stuff gets out, but it's pretty incredible.
Do you need a challenge? Because I can tell you, you need to finish it in 3 months.
I've already been like threatening Andy. I'm like, all right, man, if you're not using this, I'm just going to do a single, a one-off like right now. I'm going to find somebody else to rap on it, and we're just going to do this. So we'll probably be dropping. Honestly, that's probably going to happen like within a month, is I'll be like sneaking one of these tracks away and like finishing it out and just putting it out as a King song. So
now, Chad, if you're looking for a real challenge, Dave and I record a Christmas album every year. We'd love for you to produce it for free.
Oh boy.
And that'd be great. We'd really appreciate that.
I bet you would.
That's supposed to be a secret, because the thing is, and I guess that I'm really revealing this, where our goal is to kind of, on the DL, release a Christmas album every year.
Yeah.
And then by the time that somebody like realizes that we're trying to like set a world record, they won't be able to catch up. And so we're trying to get a substantial amount. I think we're almost at like what, Brandon? We're like eight?
Yeah, it'll be eight this year.
Eight Christmas EPs. How many songs is that?
No, they're not EPs. They're full length.
They're full length.
Give us credit where credit's due, please.
Wow. Yeah.
And you say you record an album quick? I once recorded my entire portion of the album in one night.
Dude, I bet
so you
amazing.
Can tell the quality of these are...
Yeah, they're really great. Like I said... It's a placeholder to try and set a world record, but you'll see our faces in the Guinness World Record book one day. So
that's pretty sweet. I like that.
So yeah, like we'll be sending we'll be sending some stuff out to you.
Yeah,
we appreciate you.
All right.
Thanks so much, man. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys, for having me. Appreciate it.
I look forward to seeing you guys. It's gonna be super cool.
Oh yeah, it'll be a blast.
All right, brother. Talk to you later.
Have a good night, guys. Bye.
Later.
So much for listening to the Your Favorite Band podcast. We hope you loved it. If you did, will you rate and review us on iTunes? That'd be wonderful. And go ahead and follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can find all of those at yourfavoritebandpodcast.com. Also, send us an email, yourfavoritebandpodcast@gmail.com. Let us know who you want us to interview. We have a lot of great interviews coming up. We're really excited to share them with you. So make sure you subscribe. And we'll give you some great content. We hope that you will continue to listen to us. Thank you so much for doing so today. And big thanks to King's Kaleidoscope. Go check them out on tour. Thank you, guys. Have a great week. We'll see you in a couple weeks. Bye.